looking for fun books and then figuring out how they can go along with what you're already doing in the class, like some of the concepts that you already have to hit. You know, there's so many picture books that, you know, can you could pull math concepts out of, or engineering concepts. And you could use picture books at all levels if you don't have time to do a full novel, or if, you know, you're not going to get funding to buy a classroom set of novels for your science classroom. So it's really looking at a small piece of this that you might be able to do that might be exciting to you.
You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. For hundreds of ideas, free experiments and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. And now, here's your host, Ben Newsome.
Yes, welcome again to another Physics Ed Podcast. I tell you what, yet again, we've got another big week because we get to speak with Gillian King-Cargill, who heads up StemRead. Now, if you've never come across StemRead, that's okay. You're certainly going to hear about it now. It comes out of Northern Illinois University, and it's all about inspiring readers to learn more about science, technology, engineering, and maths using popular fiction, which is an amazingly simple concept, but incredibly powerful. And the team at StemRead do an amazing job to get both the ravenous and the reluctant readers into science. They're kind of using reading as a gateway, let's be honest, but how cool is it? And they run a whole bunch of professional development programs for teachers to do exactly that, as well as run a bunch of camps themselves for the kids to not only discuss the science concepts that can be found in novels and things, but also do experiments based on what they've read about, which is so cool. Now, Gillian King-Cargill is the founder and the director of StemRead, and she's, tell you what, she's got a really interesting background. She is the director and founder of NIU StemRead, but she's also got a background in film production and creative writing, which means she also coordinates a science fiction writing competition for NIU and directs their creative writing summer day camp for middle school students. Now, she's very much about developing and nurturing local and national literary communities, and she creates a whole bunch of connections between university experts, community professionals, and learners of all ages. And I tell you what, she's got a fantastic job, without a doubt. Gillian is passionate when it comes to linking fiction and science together and getting kids to understand how it all works. And so without listening to any more about me talk about it, I'd rather hear from Gillian herself, who's got a lot to say and we've got a lot to learn.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, look, I am totally stoked that you're popping onto this, because I must say, look, we've really had a lot of fun interviewing all sorts of cool people, but gee, you've got an unusual thing that's really, I think, would just grab people's attention so fast. Gillian, tell me, what is it you do?
So I am the founder and director of the StemRead program at Northern Illinois University. And what we do is we explore science, technology, engineering, and math through fun, popular fiction books. So it is a little bit of a trick, right? we do kind of, I look at it as kind of like hiding broccoli under cheese. You know, it's how do you get people excited about science and math and STEM concepts if they're not interested in it at first, or if they think that they can't do it? So we look for fun, creative ways to get people excited about learning about those subjects.
Yeah, perhaps, I don't know, well, if that's, we call it a Freudian slip or whatever it is, but it's totally, I get it. The science by stealth is a thing. I mean, we ran a big public outreach program out in Sydney Olympic Park, and we had about 7,000 people come through. It was specifically designed to be right in between two major football games. We had all these people doing science stuff. And we're like, we should have called it science by stealth and be done with it. But I must say, you get to do something quite interesting and review some of, you know, children's and adults' favorite books with people from a STEM concept. I mean, that's just awesome.
Yeah, it's so fun. Really, what we look for first and foremost is a great story. And so oftentimes we're looking at books that kids might be excited about or adults might be excited about, but they didn't really think about using them in the classroom. One of the examples I give is Maze Runner by James Dashner. So that's a great sci-fi dystopian novel, and we have, you know, these kids are trapped in a maze, and every day they go out running through the maze looking for a way out, trying to map it, trying to discover its secrets. Every night they're terrorized by these giant mechanical slug monsters. And so you wouldn't really think about using that book in a science class or in a math class or even in an English class, because it's kind of pop fiction, you know? And so people don't often take books like that seriously in an academic setting, but really you can pull a lot of concepts out. Like, so how many calories would you need each day if you were running the maze from morning until night? How do you defend yourself from a giant mechanical slug monster? Is there something that you could engineer to keep it away from you or to trap it? And then just the cryptography that's in the book. So if the maze is moving and there's different patterns, are you, how can you recognize those patterns and what are they telling you?
But what's fun about that is that it really comes down to a fundamental literacy. What do they know what's going on? Do they actually understand their stuff to be able to pull apart a fiction book and say, well, is it fact or fiction? And that's just great. I mean, I imagine that the with the kids pulling it apart, I mean, it means that they're, effectively their imagination runs wild. It kind of reminds me of, I ran into someone at, I think it was University of Sydney. She was doing a the mathematics of a zombie apocalypse. just the idea of just, well, how would the infection rates work, et cetera, et cetera. And that's effectively, I mean, with Maze Runner, that's exactly what you could do. But you could do this with nearly every science fiction book around and even beyond science fiction.
Right, right. And we've done other zombie apocalypse things. We do have a math test, like a test prep program that one of my colleagues created that is all about the mathematics of the zombie apocalypse. So we're always looking for ways to use zombies, but definitely it's not just those books that you might think of as science fiction. I have publishers, they want to send us books and they're like, okay, I'm going to send you something like Sammy Stem builds this. And I'm like, yeah, that's good. But I want the fiction books. You know, I want the ones that tell a good story first, because that's really how we're going to connect those people who are reluctant readers or reluctant in science or math, because they need that creative entry point into it. So we've used books like The Fault in Our Stars by John Green, and we've done things like Cancer Research, Adaptive Technologies for the Blind. We actually just did a historical fiction book, which is The Detective's Assistant by Kate Hannigan. And that book is about the first female Pinkerton detective agent. And she is, she gets caught up in a, it's a little hard to explain everything that she's doing, but the upshot of all of the cases is that she's involved in thwarting an attempt to assassinate President Abraham Lincoln. And so you wouldn't think of that as a STEM book, really, but if you dig into it, really what they were doing was they were looking at coding and ciphers and trying to determine what was happening. They were looking at clues for things. And as I was digging into it, I was like, everything that they're doing are all of the skills required for computational thinking. So it's all of that pattern recognition. It's looking for clues. So it lent itself to math, to ciphers, to all these different things that really became STEM concepts. And really just the idea of being a detective is so much about observation, and in STEM, observation is key, observation and inquiry. So although you wouldn't think of using a historical fiction novel, it really worked very well.
I reckon it would, actually. And actually, the idea that it doesn't put science in a bucket, it doesn't put STEM in a bucket and say, this is the silo that you're going to work in now, and you won't worry about art, history, or anything else. You're just going to do the science thing. That's not really the case. And I like that idea that it broadens kids' minds. Just thinking right back to how STEM Read started, I mean, what made you kick off on this journey?
Well, a lot of things. So I'm not a scientist. I am a science appreciator is what I call myself. I really love science and I think it's awesome. I like watching science documentaries and reading books about science and, you know, watching SciShow on YouTube. But I kind of fell out of the science path. I loved biology. I loved epidemiology and studying weird viruses and marine biology, all the crazy creatures under the sea. And then I got to chemistry, and I couldn't connect with chemistry. And the long version of this story, if that's okay.
Yeah, go for it.
I was looking for people whose notes I could borrow so I could, you know, try to figure out what I was doing wrong in chemistry. And my friend, I saw her taking really, really good notes. Her name is Erica, and she was taking lots and lots of notes. I was like, Erica knows what she's doing in chemistry. This will be good. And I looked at her notes. I borrowed her notes, looked at them, and they just said meow over and over again. And I was like, what's going on? You're just writing meow for pages and pages. And she started singing meow, 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 the Meow Mix commercial. And I was like, oh no, I'm not going to pass chemistry. And you clearly have some issues.
Some meow issues. You got some issues, meow.
Exactly. And so we were not doing well in chemistry. And then I read Jurassic Park, and I gave her a copy of Jurassic Park, and I loved it. I've always loved dinosaurs. And she came back and she said, this is the best book ever. Scientists could make dinosaurs. And I was like, well, maybe. And she was like, no, scientists could do it. Scientists can do anything. I'm going to be a scientist. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah. Good luck with that, meow. And but
this is going to happen all the way through this interview, isn't it?
Right. So, but she cracked down in chemistry. She actually went on and she got a PhD in biophysics from Johns Hopkins University. And so, I don't think that, you know, she had never really connected in school. She always did well, but nothing kept her attention until she found a creative entry point into it, and then it started to kind of click for her. And so my background is in writing and filmmaking, so I kind of came to it from the other side and looked at, really, in storytelling is a way that we can connect to things, we remember things, we engage more if there's a compelling story. And I think that's why I fell out of chemistry. But what I really try to do in my program is find those stories, find that creative spark that will get people excited about it.
I bet. And it's really producing a platform for people just to debate a concept, I guess. I mean, do you, like, every now and then, do you have you know, people in front of you and there's a particular concept? I can imagine them having a big fight, for example, over Michael Crichton's book, that, you know, going into Jurassic Park, going, is this possible with DNA, yes or no? It could be a scientific bun fight.
I mean, I suppose
that's where the debate, and that's where potentially a lot of the learning is.
Right. Yeah. And so what we do with the books is we have experts read them. So someone who would be, you know, we haven't done Jurassic Park, but we've done things like, we've done The Martian by Andy Weir. So we talk about, you know, how close are we to colonizing Mars? How close are we to setting up a base there? You know, what barriers are there between what we have now and what they have in the book, and how are we addressing those? So it really becomes an idea of, you know, talking about what's possible and what might be possible.
And to tell you what, speaking about what might be possible, I was lucky enough to be up in Chicago sitting in amongst 10,000 of our closest friends. at the International Society for Technology and Education, as you got to speak with Andy Weir on the big stage. I mean, gee, that must have been a bit almost starry-eyed, I suspect. But how was he backstage?
Oh, I spent the week with him. So Andy Weir is the best. He was so gracious. He's so smart. And he's just really fun and sarcastic and just everything that you would, you know, imagine that he is based on his writing and his interviews. That's how he is. So, and so curious. Actually, after we went to ISTE, we got the opportunity. I took him to Argonne National Lab here in Illinois, and they do lots of different science around energy, and really they think about how they create the future. So we went and we toured nanotechnology, energy storage, and supercomputing. And it was so amazing to just watch him geek out and ask questions and get curious about every little thing in the lab and talk to these scientists who were also, you know, I think the best thing was Andy Weir, the person who was taking us through the energy storage department, said, "I want you to pop into this office and meet this guy." And he popped in, he met this researcher who was an older man, very quiet. You know, they just had a nice conversation and they walked out, and the guy who was giving us the tour said, "That's the man who invented the energy storage system for the Chevy Volt, and he's revolutionizing energy storage." And I was like, Andy Weir met the Volt guy. This is amazing. Like so much creativity, so much scientific knowledge in one place. And it was just so cool to see that happening. Just the exchange of information and curiosity.
And if anyone ever gets a chance to listen in on Andy Weir, I mean, he's got a fascinating story. He really does. And I can see he's highly curious, and I suspect I 100% know that authors are just outright, just, you know, they're writing about a particular topic that they love and exploring in great detail. And actually, just thinking about the way Andy threw together, he just threw together the Martian, let's be honest. He had a bit more work than that. But just the way that it was published bit by bit by bit by bit, and just the momentum behind, I mean, this still really just comes down to the fact that fiction, you know, books themselves, I mean, everyone talks about the net and not everything else as being like the thing that people consume, but seriously, paperback, classic hard copy things still have so much currency amongst the world. And I tell you what, if you really grab people's attention, that, you know, your ideas can spread across the planet in a heartbeat.
Right. And that's what, yeah, I think of Andy Weir, you know, his story going from being a computer science person and a software engineer and writing that book in his spare time, basically, as a hobby. He had tried to publish, it didn't work out, and he said, "I'm just going to publish this thing chapter by chapter online." And it took years. So he was an overnight success over something like 15 years of, you know, quote unquote failure. So it's a really interesting story. But, and I agree that, you know, I love that idea of what we were at Argonne to talk about was the idea of future telling and the idea that creativity is kind of this cross-cutting concept. You know, we think that artists and writers are very creative and they sit around all day in this, you know, idealized studio space being creative and, you know, churning out these books. And scientists are often thought of as these very analytical people, and they're very serious and they're doing their research and that's what they do. But scientists have to be so creative. You know, there's such a connection between the idea of what scientists are doing and what storytellers are doing, because in this concept of future telling, both of them are imagining what they'd like the future to be. You know, maybe it's 30 years from now, 50 years from now. So a science fiction author will imagine that future and write a story. And then the next generation of scientists might be inspired by that story and actually start doing those lines of research to make that story a reality. And then I love that cyclical nature of it. So science is influencing science fiction, which is influencing more science. So really both of these people are storytellers in their own way, and they're bringing about the future that might become in the next 50 to 100 years through their creativity.
Now, STEM readers really done, and oh, by the way, I agree with all that. I mean, isn't it just creativity is just the mind having fun, really, in a lot of ways? But STEM readers have done a fantastic job. I mean, you're running field trips, and by the way, congratulations over having it, a bit on the NPR as well. I mean, with the STEM Read podcast, well done with that. And with all the different bits of success, I mean, I'm guessing that occasionally things might not have gone well in your education life. I mean, this is very much a science education podcast, so I'm very much interested about not just what we do well, but also what we could possibly have improved once upon a time.
I mean, right.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about those.
Oh yeah, we screw up all the time. but I think it's a matter of being flexible and able to think on your feet and adjust. So StemRead does, we have a lot of different things that we do. So we do on our website, stemread.com, we have free lesson plans and activities that go along with these fiction books. We've also got expert videos, interactive games, and book reviews with quick picks of other books that might have a tie-in to STEM. And then we do these live author events. So these, as we call them, STEM Read field trips. So we pick a fun fiction book and we create a day-long game based on the book. So we'll bring students in, sometimes 200, sometimes up to 1,000 students that will come in and they'll read the book ahead of time, and then they'll do a day-long game where we pull out different plot points that become hands-on STEM activities throughout the day. And so they're kind of always narrative-based. They're leading up to something, usually helping or saving the main character from the book. And at the end of the day, there will be prizes, and the students get to meet the author. So, you know, with 1,000 students in a room doing hands-on activities, something is bound to go wrong, right?
Not bad.
So I would say, thinking about this, one of our biggest, I don't want to call it a screw up because it actually ended up being awesome, but one of the things that we had to adjust to on the fly was during a field trip for the I Survived series. So this is a really popular series for upper elementary, even into middle school. It's about different stories of survival throughout history. So people who have survived natural disasters or man-made disasters, and it's that first person on the ground point of view. And so we had Lauren Tarshis here on campus, and we had 1,000 kids in our basketball arena doing these hands-on activities. And we based a lot of it around the book I Survived Hurricane Katrina, because we also had one of our team members had survived Hurricane Katrina. She's from Louisiana, and so she was there during Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita. And so she told her story of survival. And then the students that day, they got a small paper bag, a plastic bin about the size of a shoebox, and then they got some popsicle sticks, about 4 popsicle sticks, about a foot of string, some paper clips, and some coffee filters. So not much, right? Mm-hmm. And what they were doing was that little bag was their secret lab. And they had to construct something with those materials and put it inside that plastic bin. And they were trying to save their secret lab from the floodwaters of Hurricane Katrina, from the storm surge. And so the students were in groups of 4. They had about 10 minutes. We kept on interrupting their work with lots of sirens and things and yelling, "Hurricane Katrina is coming! No, the water is rising! The levees will not hold!" And so we're, you know, it's all very dramatic. We have sound effects and things like that. And the kids are kind of freaking out. And they weren't, you know, totally sure what to do. We keep our directions for these things very open-ended. Just build something to save your secret lab. And so the lines were very long to test their materials. They had to take their secret lab in the bin and pour water into the bin. And then if their lab got wet, then they lost it. They lost their lab. And so the first time we did it, 99% of the students failed. So almost, you know, almost every one of the kids failed who got to test, but not all of them even got to the test because the lines were so long. And so the kids were really frustrated. They went back to their tables. They were kind of grumbling. And even the author came up to me and she was like, "Is this what's supposed to happen? This looks a little crazy." And I was like, yeah, this is actually great. Cause I just kind of huddled with my team and I said, "Hey, this is all about preparation for a hurricane. And, you know, we're talking about what happens in a hurricane. And we just had a speaker who talked about the lines being long and nobody being able to get their supplies and nobody being able to get out of the city." And so we went up and we said, "Was that hard?" And they were like, "Yeah." "So were you frustrated?" "Yeah." Oops.
That's all right. This is what, while that phone does its thing, just I can totally get that. In fact, we actually like doing that. Like, we run a lot of professional development for primary teachers, especially, so your elementary teachers and middle school types. And the one of the things that comes up is I actually love about in the middle of the day just throwing some stuff on a table going, okay, just make something. And they give you the funniest look because it's like, well, we're used to having scaffolds and reasons to make the thing and what are the instructions, blah, blah, blah. But no, I just wanted to just see what you can make. Just right. Make something. I don't care what it is. Just make something. And it's really interesting watching what happens when people get given no structure whatsoever. Or in this case, for your particular thing is that you had a structure, but of course you had some, you know, bottlenecks, which, by the way, I actually agree with you. I don't think it was just marketing spin that you were doing there. I think the fact that you were doing a genuine, long lines are going to happen. I mean, let's be honest, some people would be sprinting out the door if some things were going to, well, maybe not in a hurricane. I suppose that could be a problem. Within the failure came some grains of truth, I suppose. I mean, so you got a whole bunch of kids in the room and they're slightly grumbly and whatnot. Did they take that on board?
Well, so what actually happened then was we said, okay, so that's what people were experiencing in the hurricane. You know, they had long lines, they had shortages, they didn't know what to do. You know, they were frustrated, they were scared, they were upset. And then, you know, there was a little bit of time to recover from the storm, and then Hurricane Rita came right along behind it, you know? And so we had our speaker, our survivor, talking about that. So what happened after the hurricane was people got together, they learned, you know, what worked, what didn't. They had a chance to build community. And so we had the students, they got the opportunity to rebuild. They got a new lab, they got new supplies. They got an insurance settlement so they could buy new supplies and, you know, figure out how to do it and save their lab. So then 99% of the students passed, you know, their lab survived. So it was really, it's a thing that we now build into the activity, this idea that they're not going to have enough and they are going to fail that first time, but they get an opportunity to do it again and to think through the process and think through what were the fail points and then, you know, recover.
I agree. I really do. Like, I mean, it really does strangely parallel with that activity, because usually that we run, the teachers will come back and some people have made some really cool things and other people have kind of struggled as to how do these random bits and pieces actually come together.
Right.
What am I going to do with this thing? And I just flat out asked them, say, how did you feel? Like, don't worry about the science for now. Just for a moment, how did you feel? And some people said, felt empowered, and some people felt scared. And I said, well, right, think about it as a learner. How would that be in your room if you don't give them enough background and instructions and some reasons to do stuff?
Right.
And it really means that people can start framing their mind. In fact, actually, I was chatting with some teachers a couple of months after the fact on one of them, and they actually said, you know what, we started doing this as a, they didn't call it genius hour or something else, but the idea was that they started weekly just giving them stuff without even any direction, just to see if the kids could just explore. And the thing is, the kids find motor skills and, more importantly, their expansive mind started to come in play, because every week they knew how to do something. It meant that I kind of think that this idea that you can usually out of the ashes, the phoenix rises type of thing, that you can kind of have some things actually really work. I love it. And I love the with your with this that you've embedded in your curriculum. I'm just thinking back to, back to episode one with Adam Selinger, Children's Discovery Center out of Wollongong. He specifically, deliberately gives a task to students which he knows full well cannot, will not, will ever not, ever work, ever, can't work. And he wants the kids to actually discover that and have a go at him because he wants them to be critical thinkers. And I was like, I just wanted to clap at that point. I was like, mate, that's just spot on. That's awesome. Often we have these preconceived notions of how a outcome should be and whatnot. And that's fine to be able to produce the thing for the test or whatever it is, but that's not creative.
Right. And I think that's important for students to fail, but also to be able to try again. But I like that idea of an open-ended challenge. And that's something that we really try to do. So we have another activity that we do with a book, Iggy Peck Architect by Andrea Beatty, and it's a picture book. And at one point in the story, the class goes across this small bridge to an island and the bridge collapses and they all have to figure out how to get back. And so we say to to students, and we've done this with teachers too. We say, build something to get the class back across, you know, across the waterway. And so we don't ever say, build a bridge, you know, and a lot of the time people say, well, here's my bridge. And we're like, okay, that's great. But some people will build boats. Some people will build slingshots to kind of fling the, you know, class across the water. And that's awesome too. And, you know, one of my colleagues, Kristen Brenteson, always says, if we do an inquiry-based thing like this, and everyone has the same materials and they all come up with the same endpoint, we didn't give them a learning activity, we gave them a recipe. So what did they actually learn from it?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Now, it's a brilliant thing that you're doing, and it's fantastic that Northern Illinois University is supporting what you're doing. I mean, kind of projecting this out in the future for a couple of years ahead, I mean, where could you imagine what STEMRE could be doing?
Oh, so much. I would like to see more people doing STEMRE style activities in their classrooms and at their schools. So we're a fairly small team. We have about 2 to 3 core staff members, and then we get parts of other people's time, and we work with other experts. But, you know, I'd love to see more opportunities for people to experience the field trips, either by using our materials or by going out and being empowered to take a stab at a book that they pick. You know, there's a lot of teachers who have done training with us, and they go, I really want to do this for Hatchet, or I found this other great book and I think it could work. And we're like, yeah, go do that. You know, it's not specifically you have to use our materials. It's how can you look at a book in a different way and find that creative spark that will lead people into a STEM challenge.
Yeah, I bet. And so with that in mind, what sort of advice would you have for a teacher who's just embarking on the journey? Obviously, you know, teachers do, you know, literacy stuff all the time, but being able to look at any books from a scientific, from a STEM lens, from a how can I pick apart some ideas? What are sort of things that, you know, just like that, weren't able to engage with you or be involved in your professional development sessions or anything that you do, you know, because, you know, hey, the globe's a big place. the course of that, they've got to sort of find their own way through this. I mean, what are some first steps for that you could suggest for some teachers that were putting together some lesson plans or something around this idea to pull apart a fiction book and turn it into a STEM concept?
Well, I think you don't have to start from scratch. A lot of people think when they're being asked to start teaching STEM or something like that, that they have to throw away their old lessons and their old way of doing things. And that's not the case. I think it's really looking for fun books and then figuring out how they can go along with what you're already doing in the class, like some of the concepts that you already have to hit. You know, there's so many picture books that, you know, you could pull math concepts out of, or engineering concepts. And you could use picture books at all levels if you don't have time to do a full novel, or if, you know, you're not going to get funding to buy a classroom set of novels for your science classroom. So it's really looking at a small piece of this that you might be able to do that might be exciting to you, and then find other people who are excited about it. So if you're an English teacher who wants to approach STEM, you know, find a science teacher who is a little bit excited about reading or is looking for new things to do. Definitely work with a coalition of the willing, and really, really, if you have people who are excited about it, then it's going to be so much easier to implement things.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's pretty hard to move the needle when no one wants to touch it.
Right, yeah. And then I think the other thing is just being okay with the learning being loud and messy, and with your plans not necessarily working out all the time. And I think that's a powerful thing, too, when we can show our students that, you know, sometimes we fail, or sometimes we're just trying things out and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. That, you know, that helps it, you know, getting that growth mindset idea that I might be your teacher, but I'm still learning too, and I'm doing this right along with you. So don't be afraid of that, the unpredictability of the activities and of not really knowing how they're going to turn out. But then, you know, build in that time to really look at them and talk about what worked and kind of analyze what you're doing and becoming, you know, more critical thinkers.
Absolutely. Now, of course, whilst the world is a big place, we have this thing called the internet, which means people can totally connect with what you do. So, yes. Jillian, how do they get in touch with you?
So, a lot of the activities that I've talked about are on stemread.com. So all of our activities are free and open to the public. They're Creative Commons licensed, so you can share them, remix them, and, you know, trade them with your friends and all that good stuff. And we also have the StemRead podcast, which is on NPR and iTunes and available from the StemRead website. And then we do lots of conferences throughout the United States, and we're available for professional development as well.
Fantastic. And it really is awesome how, I mean, you can be working with reluctant readers through to people who just can't put the books down. and everything in between. It's fantastic. And I just love how you really are bringing STEM to light in a way that it's not just the traditional way. I mean, it's amongst fiction itself and then finding the grains of truth. It's fantastic. And imagine, I surely at home, you must have so many books. What are you, tripping over them or something? I heard something.
Yeah, I have an embarrassing amount of books, being a writer, and my husband worked at a bookstore. He's a writer as well, and he worked at a bookstore for a while. And so we have, you know, whenever we move, like there was a, you know, when we were moving from an apartment to a house, we actually moved books in secret before my family came to help us move. So they, because the last time they'd helped us move, they were like, you sure do have a lot of books. So, yeah. But it's fun. It's fun to see, you know, so many ways that stories can be told and just, you know, everything that's happening in writing. I love to hear new stories and new points of view. So.
Yeah. It kind of, no, it sort of flashed to mind. It reminds me of that. There's a thing going through Facebook right now. I can't remember if it's education or not, but the quote's effectively like, education seriously damages your ignorance.
Yes.
And this is true. And imagine it. The more books, the better. And actually, I even heard some research. There's something to be said for even just having the books, let alone going through them, actually does something for your perceptions of the world, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But look, thank you very much, Jillian. I know you have a very flat out day and then moving into your evening. You've got to go into your evening tasks. But look, much appreciated. And look, glad to have you on the Phys Ed podcast. And we might catch you another time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. We've got tons of new things coming up, so we're always excited to have you, you know, be talking about them all over the place. We're doing activities with the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein this year. We're doing Peter Brown's Wild Robot, looking at nature and also robotics and how they will meet in the future. And then we've also got Aaron Starmer coming up with, we're doing several of his books, but we're also looking at The River Man and looking at a creative writing workshop, which will also be creative writing and world building with psychologists and neuroscientists talking about what is happening in your brain when you are creating these worlds. So lots of more exciting topics to explore.
Yeah, and you've got all thousands and thousands of books to go yet, so you're not going to be short anytime soon. Good on you, Jillian. Love your work.
Well, thank you so much.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast. We're excited about science. Grab a copy of our new book, Be Amazing, How to Teach Science the Way Primary Kids Love, from our website. Just search Be Amazing Book. It's available in hard copy and ebook. Go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled FIZZICS.
Well, there we go. We were speaking with Jillian King-Cargill, who must be having a blast, I must say. You can tell that she really loves what she does and she really makes a genuine impact with the students that she interacts with. So, what does this mean for us? Obviously, it'd be unreal if you connect with Northern Illinois University STEM read. I mean, that'd be fantastic if you can, but there's no reason why you can't do the same thing in your own school, your own library, your own museum, wherever you happen to be. Why not look at some popular fiction works that kids could dive deeper into? And actually, why not actually get kids to, well, submit their own ideas about what we should tease out of when it comes to fiction writing? There's so much STEM out there, and it doesn't matter whether it's a year one book or all the way up to grade 12, there is 100% something that you could be working with students that they could be reading about in their own time and then discussing after the fact in your classrooms. The kids will get a lot out of it. And tell you what, if you can get the kids to actually model the scientific concepts using real materials, just like in any other makerspace, that would bring the books to life. And I really love what Gillian's been doing. And I love her, her headspace around, you know, also dealing with a bit of failure every now and then, because that's also something that's good for us as educators to do. As well, it kind of humanizes us. It shows that, hey, we can make mistakes as we go along too, and we can grow from them. So I hope you enjoyed listening to Gillian, and I hope you connect if you can with STEM Read. And by the way, go check out STEM Read's podcast. They are on NPR. Just type in STEM Read podcast. You'll find it without a doubt, and you will enjoy it for sure. So anyway, enough from us for this week. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I hope you've been enjoying lots of the episodes in the past. And by the way, if you have been listening for the last little while, and there are over 60 episodes, leave a review if you have a chance, because it lets people know that perhaps what we're doing might be of some value for them and may be worth their time on their drive home or walking the dog or whatever it is they actually do. But anyway, we do have more episodes coming up. We certainly do. You've been listening to me, Ben Newsome, Phys Education. I will catch you next time, but I hope you're making your place vibrantly scientific and everything else. And why not work a little bit of science fiction into it, a little bit too? Grab their imagination. Have a fantastic time. I will catch you next week.
You've been listening to another Physics Ed podcast. We're excited about science. Subscribe to us on iTunes to download the next episode as soon as it's released. And don't forget, for hundreds of ideas, free experiments, our new Be Amazing book and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled F-I-Z-Z-I-C-S.
Well, there we go. We were speaking with Gillian King-Cargill, who must be having a blast, I must say. You can tell that she really loves what she does, and she really makes a genuine impact with the students that she interacts with. So what does this mean for us? Obviously, it'd be unreal if you connect with Northern Illinois University STEM Read. I mean, that'd be fantastic if you can, but there's no reason why you can't do the same thing in your own school, your own library, your own museum, wherever you happen to be. Why not look at some popular fiction works that kids could dive deeper into? And actually, why not actually get kids to, well, submit their own ideas about what we should tease out of when it comes to fiction writing? There's so much STEM out there, and it doesn't matter whether it's a year one book or all the way up to grade 12, there is 100% something that you could be working with students that they could be reading about in their own time and then discussing after the fact in your classrooms. The kids will get a lot out of it. And tell you what, if you can get the kids to actually model the scientific concepts using real materials, just like in any other makerspace, that would bring the books to life. And I really love what Gillian's been doing, and I love her, her headspace around, you know, also dealing with a bit of failure every now and then, because that's also something that's good for us as educators to do. As well, it kind of humanizes us. It shows that, hey, we can make mistakes as we go along too, and we can grow from them. So I hope you enjoyed listening to Gillian, and I hope you connect if you can with STEM Read. And by the way, go check out STEM Read's podcast. They are on NPR. Just type in STEM Read podcast. You'll find it without a doubt, and you will enjoy it for sure. So anyway, enough from us for this week. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I hope you've been enjoying lots of the episodes in the past. And by the way, if you have been listening for the last little while, and there are over 60 episodes, leave a review if you have a chance, because it lets people know that perhaps what we're doing might be of some value for them and may be worth their time on their drive home or walking the dog or whatever it is they actually do. But anyway, we do have more episodes coming up. We certainly do. You've been listening to me, Ben Newsome, Phys Education. I will catch you next time, but I hope you're making your place vibrantly scientific and everything else. And why not work a little bit of science fiction into it, a little bit too? Grab their imagination. Have a fantastic time. I will catch you next week.